Friday, June the 12th, was the third of the season's big luncheons. The first, the Senate Wives for me, and then the Congressional Club for me, and now my return engagement for the Senate Wives Red Cross Unit. The morning was one of those frustrating wastelands of work, the sort of digging away at paper that doesn't seem to accomplish much. An hour on the Australian dinner list, autographing innumerable pictures. About 2 weeks after I've returned from a trip, there's a big stack on my desk of pictures to be autographed for all the people who have helped on it. One thing that makes me keep on doing it is I remember the glow I used to get when Mrs. Kennedy would have pictures sent to me from White House functions. They were not signed, but each one to me represented a big event in my life. As this luncheon approaches, I always phone Mrs. Truman to invite her before sending out her invitation. And for the first year or two to this, as to all similar events, I phoned Mrs. Kennedy, finally when it became too painful for us both, I think. I asked Bess to phone her secretary. The answer, of course, has always been that she cannot come. And, of course, I always phone Mrs. Eisenhower. And last year she came, and this year she's coming. I am delighted, and her presence help makes the party. I dressed in my pink Ben Zuckerman and went down a minute or two before one when I heard that Mrs. Eisenhower had arrived. She was beaming, looking well, had come straight from the hospital where the general had gone on, I think it was Monday, with a stomach attack. Later, I read in the paper that Winslow McClendon said, Mamie Eisenhower came back to the White House as a guest yesterday, looking not a day older, some thought looking younger, than when she was first lady. For all that she doesn't oblige them with interviews and such, she really is a favorite of the press. Now, is that one of the bonuses of being an ex-first lady? I wonder. First, Mrs. Eisenhower and I had our pictures made in the green room on the Daniel Webster sofa, and then, with after a glass of sherry, we stood for the line to come in. All the cabinet was there, every one of the 12, a most unusual event, and of course, Muriel. First in the line of the Senate ladies were the two Henriettas, Henrietta Anderson of New Mexico, helping Henrietta Hill of Alabama, who can barely walk. Parkinson's disease, I believe it is. They're two of my oldest and best friends among the Senate ladies. And then Bethine Church, who spent much of the spring campaigning back in Idaho in preparation for next year. And much as her husband deserts this administration's foreign policy, my fondness for Bethine still holds. And smart, amusing Lorraine Cooper, wearing net stockings, shoes that look like the pilgrims owned them, black with big buckles, and at her throat, a jewel. 7-star sapphires set in what appeared to be a galaxy of stars. She told me it was the Pleiades, the 7 sisters. She has dash and style and is very entertaining. I like her. All eyes were on the new Mrs. Daniel Brewster, who seemed quiet enough, pleasant, slender, not as pretty as the last Mrs. Brewster, I thought, but in this crowd, I'd say the cards were stacked against her. The married women's union will not feel kindly toward her for at least a year, 2 years. I noticed that Grace Dodd did not come, and I was sad. But some of those who never come showed up. Mrs. James Eastland was there, always warm and courteous in that southern manner. And both Ethel Kennedy and Mrs. Ted Kennedy, the last, ravishingly beautiful and very pregnant. Her baby is due the last of June, she said. This is about the only party at which the Kennedys ever darken the door. And yet, we keep on inviting them when the occasion is appropriate. I smiled to myself when I thought of how Lyndon always teases me about loving Washington and about how I shall be coming back many years from now on my cane, tottering to these parties. For indeed, several ladies did come on canes. Mrs. Ernest Greening came on too, moving with great difficulty. And Mrs. Henry Parkinson Kyes in a wheelchair, huge and ponderous in a purple dress. Her relationship with the Senate ladies is very tenuous. Her husband was a senator from New York, Lord knows how long ago, perhaps about 1912. But this is a party she never misses. I wonder if we are grist for the mills of some of her books. And Mrs. J. Ham Lewis, who has not shown up at a party in over a year, came tottering feebly, escorted by a colored nurse in uniform who waited outside after she had delivered her to the table. She told me this was her debut. I was flattered that she would make the effort to come. And Lou Tower, who is far too young to need a cane, came with her leg in a cast, remarking laughingly that someone had said they'd heard the Republican women had had a big fight up here, but they didn't know it had been that bad. I think Betty Fulbright and I always impart a little extra warmth to our greeting because our husbands these days are finding each other prickly companions, and the same applies to Pauline Goa. There were lots of old-timers, Mary Holland of Florida, who looked ill, Ivo Sparkman, and Coy Stennis, looking much as when I'd first met them years ago, Mrs. Dennis Chavis and Lucille Connolly, Esther Freer, bright and sweet, and serenely beautiful Rosemary Silvercruz, and the long roster of widows, Lou Engle and Elizabeth Hennings, and Mrs. Irving Ives of New York. We practically fell into each other's arms. We'd been good friends on the International Club. And gingery Katie Malone. She and many, many others greeted Mrs. Eisenhower with a hug and a kiss. It was so pleasant to watch Mrs. Eisenhower with the ladies, the warmth of conversation with many of them. And she greeted all the photographers and said to one of them, "How's your son?" And she called several of the servants by name and asked about others. I'd laid out on the round table in the blue room several of my albums that I thought the ladies might look at while having their sherry and Dubonnet. The history of the Senate ladies themselves, their gift to me, an album they had given me another year, now filled with pictures of my life here, and Lucy's wedding album, which she had given me at Christmas. Bess and I had searched for little things to add to the gaiety of their party. What's more, we were using china from all the administrations, beginning with George Washington, a different set on each table with a sign denoting the administration, so that the state dining room was a potpourri of history, and we had chosen the menu after research through old cookbooks, coming up with favorite recipes, beginning with quaking jelly from Monroe's days, the recipe for which said, "Take 3 calves feet with the hoofs still on, boil for 5 days. But we had decided to use Knox's gelatin instead. And then going on to one of Thomas Jefferson's favorites, panna cakes, which are really crepes, filled with chicken and crab meat. And a beautiful bouquet of vegetables, which was said to be a favorite of John Adams, especially for the 4th of July. And then for dessert, there was creme brulee hermitage, Andrew Jackson's favorite dessert, which he called burnt cream. That star in the White House's crown, Sandy Fox, had done up the menus in the most delightful old-fashioned script. And it made a rather good conversation piece, except, alas, most of the ladies were too old to be able to see it very well without getting out their glasses. Chris and I had chosen my table carefully. We were seated right under President Lincoln. On my right, I had Mrs. Eisenhower. And next, Mrs. Dixon, and Mary Ellen Monroney, an asset at any party, and Vicki Hruska, one of my favorite Republicans, and the first vice president in the Senate Ladies' Red Cross, and lovely, slim Helen Jackson, Mrs. Scoop, in whose home we've had 2 such delightful evenings, and Mrs. Topi, because she is really the heart and soul of the Senate Ladies' Red Cross, as well as having wit and charm. And Norma McClellan of Arkansas, and Muriel on my left, who is leaving almost immediately afterward for another trip. They're constantly gone these days. Everyone was asking Mrs. Eisenhower about the general, of course. She said, "He's doing better. He's having his first solid food today. If he wasn't all right, I wouldn't be here." I asked her if she played bridge. She said, "No, that's the general's game. We never do anything together. Maybe that's one reason we've been married 51 years. The new Mrs. Brewster naturally came up for discussion, and the sticky question of whether one remained a member of the Senate wives after one was divorced from one's senator husband. A question not quite resolved by the bylaws of the organization. And in the course of talking about the remarriages of some of our older friends,
Mrs. Eisenhower
said the nicest thing about her husband. She said, "You know, Ike never has a bad word to say about anybody."
I indeed believe it,
and I think it adds so much to his mental health and enjoyment of life.
I was inwardly praising her own radiance
and zest.
But somehow, like
a wound-up top that has been spinning until it is about to run down and fall,
I found
myself unable to sparkle and give forth, although this is one of the days of the year I look most forward to. An unfortunate incident occurred.
Mrs. Dirksen
turned to us, obviously disturbed, and said, "Will you forgive me? Joy is sick. She's down at the dispensary. I'll begin lunch, but may I leave after the first course? I'm worried about her. I'm going to take her home." Of course, we reassured her and said she must go. And I asked if the doctor were with her, if there was anything we could do. No.
She'd just gotten up too soon after a bout of virus.
And so, after all our planning, there was no one on Mrs. Eisenhower's right,
which she gracefully ignored.
After Andrew Jackson's burnt cream, a very nice young man, Dick Coleman, who's playing at the National, sang some familiar songs to us.
The sort designed for a middle-aged female audience. "The Girl That I Marry," "For Me and My Gal." Then, a little past three, the party was over, and I bid Mrs. Eisenhower goodbye at the elevator, staying to chat with the last lady, and was back upstairs to do some more work with Ashton and lie down for a nap. Fruitless. But I find myself very weary, and though it goes against the grain to admit it, tired of crowds of people.
At 5 o'clock, I got up and dressed and went down to the library to meet people
with the unlikely name of Pizzy. He's what corresponds to the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Queensland, and we had met him on a never-to-be-forgotten trip to Australia. Now in line for becoming governor, he's out to spend 3 months seeing the world. A deliberate cram course. Lyndon was in the library having tea with them. I joined them and we talked about Expo 67. They talked about the Australian exhibit there. A comfortable room, lined floor, walls, ceiling, with their chief export, white wool, with form-fitting chairs into which you can relax and hear very quietly a tape in Lord Menzies' wonderful voice of the story of Australia. A very good idea for foot-weary travelers. And then upstairs to the Truman balcony to see Robin Duke, back from Spain for a 2 months vacation. My face ached with smiling. I was tired of trying to be pleasant, and I told Ashton, all too truly, that I didn't want to see any more folks. But Robin wasn't folks. She's the freshest, most natural person I know. And it was a delightful hour sitting out on the Truman balcony, looking out over the tulips and watching the light change and fade. She reminded me how she had campaigned in 64 with Mary Kosling and said, "I'm ready to go out again. I want you to tell the president." When she left, I worked a while. Lyndon had called me that Senator Russell was coming to dinner. It was nearly 9 o'clock when he arrived. Lyndon had asked me to bring him over to his office, and I had hoped to dislodge him from what was going on and bring them both home to dinner soon. I found them in the little green office where most that's interesting takes place, with Francis Bator and Harry McPherson talking about the Kennedy rounds, trade, the European situation. We all had a drink, Lyndon his usual root beer, and the business was so compelling, the talk so interesting, that it was nearly 11 o'clock before we came home to dinner, bringing with us Harry McPherson and Marie, and of course Dick Russell. At dinner, the discussion got around to the Russian ambassador and his influence, together with the rest of their propaganda machine, upon the members of the Senate and the staff of Senate committees. No question that they were loyal, well-intentioned citizens, but after a luncheon or a dinner with Dobrynin or certain others, their statements, their speeches, took on a coloration that meant they had been impressed or convinced. I was startled to hear Lyndon make the statement that the ambassador of Russia has more influence in the Senate than the President of the United States. The subject got on to press coverage at parties, especially the judicial reception and the upcoming state dinners. We disagreed flatly, Lyndon and I. I tried to be judicious, persuasive, mild. I failed completely, and I went to bed mad.